Well, one of the things that I use as the premise of the book is that belonging is true. It's not up for debate, as far as I'm concerned. It's a fundamental fact that we all belong to everything. And I use as evidence for this the fact that both ancient wisdom, Buddhism being the one that I'm primarily mostly connected to, but all wisdom traditions throughout time talk about the fact that we are interconnected. And also, contemporary science tells us this. And we also experience the world as disparate, you know, as unique, as relative, as separate bodies, separate experiences, too. So this is a paradox. And the thing about it is that they're both true, that one is not more true than the other, or truthier. And this is the challenge of belonging, that we have to kind of find our own reckoning with these two truths, that we are not separate and we are not the same.
That was Sabine Selassie, and this is Create Belonging. I am Matteo Bornico, and this is the podcast where we explore the world through the lens of belonging. Today, I have the absolute privilege of speaking with the writer, meditation teacher, Sabine Selassie. Sabine is a self-described nerdy, black, immigrant, tomboy, Buddhist, weirdo. And she is the author of You Belong, A Call for Connection. For those that are listeners to the show, you already know how influential this book has been in uncovering many of the philosophical, spiritual, and even practical underpinnings of my own belonging. Sabine, she is a well-sought-after meditation teacher and has been a teacher in hundreds, if not thousands, of retreats at some of the world's most prestigious centers, including the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, founded by Jack Kornfield. She's also one of the core meditation teachers of the 10% Happier meditation app. Sabine is also a four-time stage 3 and stage 4 cancer survivor, which she generously and openly shares her challenges in her book and in her writings. Previously, Sabine worked for over 20 years with many young people and families as a social worker, a work that has taken her around the world from the Tenderloin neighborhood in San Francisco to Guinea in West Africa. She currently writes on her monthly newsletter that is scheduled in accordance to the moon cycles. And I highly recommend her newsletter, where she shares glimpses of her own personal life, as well as she invites her readers to reflect on deeper truths with a refreshing insights into ways of exploring our lives. The newsletter is free to subscribe, and you can find it on her website at sabineselassie.com. So in case you can't tell, Sabine is one of my heroes when it comes to belonging. When I set up this podcast, she was in my top 5 humans that I wanted to have on the pod. So after I attended one of her workshops on reconnecting with our ancestors, I was thrilled that she decided to come as a guest. As Sabine is, she was very generous with her time, and we ended up speaking for over 2 hours. There was so much wisdom and insights shared that I decided to split this interview into multiple parts. So in this first part, we cover her motivations for writing her book, her background, and encounters with belonging. She explains that her book is not a map for belonging, rather a map key, and warns us of the dangers of using somebody else's map for belonging. Instead, she challenges us to use these map keys to create our own maps and to find our own belonging. We also explore the paradox of belonging. We touch on some of the systemic reasons on why individuals and our society at large is suffering from an illusion of separation. And then we explore ways of getting back to our belonging and why it's fundamental to start with grounding ourselves before we begin to truly know ourselves. We explore cultivating embodied awareness, which is Sabine's preferred translation of the term that we normally know as mindfulness, and how this embodied awareness can offer us a deeper way of understanding our true nature. And it also gives us clues into understanding the absolute truth of belonging, that you belong. So in this conversation, we cover a lot of ground. Sabine was not only generous with her time, but also with her wisdom. As you know, it's taken me some time to finally publish this interview, and I am so glad I managed to overcome my difficulties and be able to share this with you now. So I hope you really enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And now, with a huge smile on my face, I welcome Sabine Selassie. Welcome to Create Belonging, Sabine.
Thank you, Matteo. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Where to start? I mean, your book was so inspirational. Words cannot describe how much this book meant to me. And I thought about starting a little bit with your story and why did you feel compelled to write this book?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so this book is about belonging. And I like to say that I wrote a book about belonging because I didn't feel like I belonged for so long. So I, half Ethiopian, half Eritrean. I was born in Ethiopia, but we moved to the US when I was three. This was in the early 70s. So now there's a very large Ethiopian and Eritrean community in Washington, DC, where we moved. But back then we were, you know, a handful of families, really. This was before the revolution of 74, definitely before the wars and conflict that led to the big movement of refugees and immigrants in the 80s. So I grew up Black and immigrant in predominantly white neighborhoods. I grew up not wealthy in upper middle class communities. I went to largely white schools, and I always felt like I didn't belong. And this only intensified kind of as I grew in adolescence and young adulthood, because I also didn't really identify with dominant culture around me. So I was, you know, kind of an alternative kid and not really rebellious in acting out, because I was too good of an immigrant daughter to be too outwardly rebellious and cause my parents grief. But definitely feel like I didn't fit into kind of the aspirational culture of school and, you know, chasing status or money. And I also didn't really identify with a lot of kind of, oh, you know, get a job, get married. And when I was in college, I started hanging out in a queer community, even though I'm straight. And so there were just all these markers that made me different. For a long time, I think that was a source of discomfort and sometimes really like pain. Like really feeling like there was something wrong with me. And it was only when I started really getting deeper into Buddhism and to meditation that I started to find that sense of belonging and really home inside myself, and began to relate that to the outer world as well.
The concept of home is something that we touch here often on Create Belonging. And I just found it so amazing how you and I on the surface could be worlds apart, but I managed to relate so much to your book. Me being a young immigrant from Argentina, I was 9 years old when I moved to Canada. And I remember all I wanted to do at that age was to fit in. And I was the weird kid with the accent. That's something that I haven't thought of a lot. When I got your book, it really made me self-reflect. And I think it speaks true to what you're trying to accomplish with your book. And one of the metaphors that you use is that your book is not a map, but it's a map key to belonging. Can you explain that metaphor a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I really love this idea that we each have to make our own maps. And I don't mention this in the book, but that actually comes from a Joy Harjo poem. And Joy Harjo is the poet laureate of the U.S. She's a native Muscogee Nation poet. And she has a poem that talks about making a map to our own belonging, basically. And in the end, she says, we each must make our own maps. And I so firmly believe that, because one of the things I learned about not belonging is if we try and use others' maps, we won't find our own belonging, because it's so unique. It's unique to each of our stories and our experiences and our backgrounds and our diversity and our uniqueness. And sometimes even spiritual practice can become this project of using other people's maps and thinking that your practice, your understanding of the world or yourself has to match someone else's. And so for me, it's really about using these tools, and that could be the legend or map key. And I primarily talk about the tools of meditation and mindfulness in the book, but I've also engaged many other tools in my life, including therapy and knowledge systems and wisdom traditions, and using those not as someone else's maps that we kind of just try and fit into our own territory, but as tools to help us create our own maps to belonging.
I think if you find yourself applying somebody else's maps and you're still in that dynamic where you're trying to fit in and trying to seek belonging through external means, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that can be as like simple as learning certain meditation techniques and thinking that you have to do it a particular way, even when it's not working for you. So if I take the example of, if I just jump right into meditation.
No, please.
I think so much of what I talk about.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Yeah.
You are a meditation teacher. And
yeah, right.
I was definitely going to touch it eventually. So I'm so glad that you're getting right into it.
That's where I go right away.
Yeah, please.
So I learned by sort of going to certain centers and imitating and listening to what was taught and applying it to myself. And some of it didn't work, you know, it didn't really suit me, you know, particular techniques or particular maps that really didn't suit my body or what I was going through at the time. You know, for years with a young, agile body, it was very easy for me to sit up kind of ramrod straight and still feel relaxed, although I didn't, because I was neurotic and tense inside. But my body wasn't suffering from, you know, kind of strain or stress. And when I went through cancer treatment in my mid-late 30s, my body was really suffering, you know, physically. And I was still trying to sit up during meditation. It was actually one of my teachers he suffered from typhoid for 3 years in Thailand and had to lie down. He had to basically lie down for 3 years and talked about his practice lying down. And I never really invited a lying down practice, because that's not what you learn in retreat centers or in meditation and community. And when I started lying down in my practice, everything shifted. And there was this sense of relaxation that came. So there's right there is, you know, a map key that is actually part of the legend, but not necessarily drawn on anyone's map, because lying down meditation is one of the formal postures. So it's really about sort of experimenting and exploring territory and seeing what possibilities there are, instead of just trying to copy someone else's map onto to yourself.
Yeah, that example of just lying down, it's something that it's like you talk about this over and over. It's something that it's so simple, but yet it's so profound. There's many, many examples that you give throughout your book. And it kind of leads to the nature of belonging, that it is simple in itself, but yet it's very profound, and it involves it's not easy to do. And I think it's part of that, and you touched this on your book, part of that is because the way our systems and our society is structured, it's not, at least our modern society is not made for belonging. And why do you think that is?
Well, one of the things that I use as the premise of the book is that belonging is true. It's not up for debate, as far as I'm concerned. It's a fundamental fact that we all belong to everything. And I use as evidence for this the fact that both ancient wisdom, Buddhism being the one that I'm primarily mostly connected to, but all wisdom traditions throughout time talk about the fact that we are interconnected, that we are not separate. There's this truth to our belonging that is really a fundamental part of spiritual truth and knowledge. And also contemporary science tells us this, that once we got over kind of the limited understanding of Newtonian physics, there was this deeper understanding, you know, starting in Einstein's time and extending outward, that there is this fundamental interconnection that can be described in different ways, but you know, some modern physicists describe it as kind of vibrating energy pattern that is the truth of our connection. So we learn that the world is made of all of these bigger and then smaller parts going down to subatomic levels. But the theory now is that actually you can't get to the smallest unit, that as you go down and down and down, it's just going to be interconnection. That smallest unit doesn't exist except as oneness. And so that's a very profound truth that, you know, we all started 14 billion years ago from the same infinitesimally small, you know, spot or dot, that we're all basically made of stardust. And there's such a mystery and wonder to that. And so there's that truth that there is this fundamental interconnection, and that's undeniable. That's the truth of belonging. And we also experience the world as disparate, you know, as unique, as relative, as, you know, separate bodies, separate experiences, you know, separate consciousnesses, plural, but ultimately that is one consciousness too. So this is a paradox. And in Buddhism, it's called the paradox of the absolute and the relative, sometimes called the paradox of the two truths. And the thing about it is that they're both true, that one is not more true than the other, or truthier. And this is, I think, the challenge of belonging, that we have to kind of find our own reckoning with these two truths, that we are not separate and we are not the same.
Yeah. And the paradox of belonging is something that I've learned just through your book and just through, from feeling. There is both in me my desire to be recognized as an individual, and I have my own set of experiences and my own story, but yet I am interconnected with other people and I am other people. And the second one, the universal truth of that we, everything is connected, I think that you mentioned it very well, that that got lost along the way through many series of events and through history.
Yeah, you know, I really don't know the origins of the split caused by difference, but the fact that we are different is not a problem. So we are not separate, but we are not the same, is a paradox, but it's not a conflict necessarily. We could celebrate difference and, you know, really revel in our uniqueness, but that's not what's happened over time. Actually, that difference, for probably many reasons throughout his human history, has led to a delusion of separation. So instead of difference, we really created the concepts of separation and division, and those led to many, many systems over the years of conflict and dominance and separation and oppression and injustice eventually. And so we live inside these systems that are really unable to reckon with that paradox. Some systems really denying our interconnection at all, and really going through the world as humans, not recognizing that we are interconnected with each other and also with the rest of nature. So that's led to the degradation of land and the exploitation of resources, It's also led to the oppression of people, in often in service of the exploitation of land and resources.
Yeah.
And it's led to, you know, a lot of suffering.
Yeah. Some of the things you talk about on your book is on this idea that we have a finite amount of resources, and so people are trying to covet it as much as possible. And then that leads to a power dynamic where a certain ruling class looks down or controls and dominates not just the resources, but everything else that everybody else that comes below that. And you could see those patterns throughout society, throughout history. And I mean, it's quite obvious why or how we lost our ability to connect to the deeper truth of the universal truth of that everything is connected and we're all together.
Yeah, you know, so we're touching on kind of systemic issues, which are really important to explore and understand. And this book acknowledges them, but it's really a book about our own personal work, because we cannot solve these systemic issues if we don't tend to these delusions within ourselves. And I use this quote by bell hooks, I'll paraphrase, where she says, you know, if you're effed up and you lead the revolution, you're going to have an effed up revolution. And so when we as individuals try and remedy these systems of separation that exist in the world, but we haven't actually even acknowledged our delusions of separation within ourselves, we're just going to perpetuate the same systems, maybe in softer forms or changing the characters around, but we're not really going to have true revolution of consciousness. So these delusions, we really have to look at in ourselves, you know, and often we want to solve the problems out there. And that delusion of separation in ourselves really shows up as that feeling of separation from others. It, you know, even if we may have ideas of equality and, you know, not feel ourselves to be categorizing or creating a hierarchy of people or communities by race or gender, culture or sexuality, we still might be participating in systems of domination because we are constantly evaluating and judging and creating hierarchies internally. And I call it, you know, this pattern of comparison and competition. And it starts really young. You know, it starts when we're kids and we start getting evaluated right away. You know, how quickly are we talking and walking, and you know, how well are we performing? And there's constant evaluation, and you know, that's part of our society. I don't think we're going to eliminate those things. We're not going to eliminate tests and grades, and although you know, we can hope, but there, and of course, there are some school systems and theories and methodologies that do try and mitigate that and change that. And I think it's very helpful. You know, I actually happened to go to an alternative high school, and we didn't have grade point averages. Things weren't posted. There were no rankings. And I think it really benefited me. I think it would have been really hard to be in a system that added to already heavy feelings of separation and comparison that I was making. You know, I didn't feel like I really lived up to the comparisons of popular culture and media at the time. I didn't look like what was on TV. And so if I had to have added the like academic comparisons to that, it would have been a heavy toll. But most kids live in that and forget social media today. I mean, there's this constant comparison and competition. And so even in just those what seem like small ways, we're already participating in this delusion of separation because we're caught in these systems of domination that are based on comparison and competition. So part of our work is really seeing that and unwinding from that. And that's internal work.
Yeah, you talk about that. There's an ancient term in Buddhism called mana, which is the comparing mind, and how, you know, our brain or our mind is always involved in measuring, comparing ourselves to other things. Either we're the same, inferior, superior, or the same. And I just found it fascinating how even that is like, it's a condition that people before us have had to wrestle with. I don't think when they came up with that term or they were thinking that way, they had no idea what society might become with our, you know, our smartphones and social media and so on. But yet we're still in the same paradigm. Perhaps mm-hmm. now it's more accelerated.
Yeah, the thing I love about mana, this word that you brought up, it's a Pali word, is that it is, which means to measure. So it's that measuring is, as you said, it's you know, greater than, less than, and equal to. So even equality is a form of measurement. So we see equality as the goal, and it is in some ways. That's maybe the baseline we could get to, or like the, you know, the very basic goal of ours. But this is asking for kind of an even greater goal, which is non-separation and interconnection. And the other thing that's really powerful about mana as a concept, this fact of comparing mind, is that it's part of the human mind. It's not something that we're going to eliminate. It's said that it's one of the very last things to drop away before enlightenment. And we, you know, we hope we become an enlightened society. But until then, we need to mitigate mana, because we're not necessarily going to eliminate it. But I think the more we kind of talk about it and talk about comparison and competition as often unskillful and unhelpful dynamics, we can mitigate it and hopefully come closer to that truth of interconnection.
So we kind of established a little bit what's happening in the world around, like you rightfully mentioned that we're kind of on the systemic level right now. And we talked about how our society is not geared for belonging, but the work itself has to start from us, from within. Of course, I think it's very important to understand where we come from. But can you talk a little bit more why that is important?
So the book goes through sort of five semi-sequential steps, which I just use as sort of map keys or legends for belonging. And so it starts with ground yourself, because if we cannot cultivate an embodied awareness that allows us to be really centered, connected to our felt sense experience, we will continue.
Sorry to interrupt, but can you explain the term embodied awareness and where does that come from?
Oh, yeah. So I use the term embodied awareness and in replacement of mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is a great term in a lot of ways. It's the translation of this Pali term, sati. We translated it as mindfulness. The problem with mindfulness is it can make us think that it's just an intellectual experience, that, you know, somehow we're thinking about our experience and that's how we come to, you know, greater freedom and greater sense of belonging. But it's more complicated than that. Of course, the mind is involved and there is thoughtfulness to awareness, but awareness is so much more than just our thoughts or our thinking mind. It really is global personal experience. And our bodies are a huge part of that. And part of the problem with calling it mindfulness is it perpetuates this largely Western, but I would say just modern, modernity covers the whole globe. This modern tendency to be sort of stuck in our rational minds and have a disconnection from our bodies. So embodied awareness is really inviting us into this felt sense experience. Like we really can feel our the entirety of our experience, that we're not just stuck in our heads and our thoughts, which is, you know, what kind of modernity, including schooling and so much of the way we learn and move through the world now encourages. So even right now, like I'm feeling my feet as I speak to you, and I often go to my feet as a way to ground and have this more integrated meaning whole, you know, like integral kind of experience of life. So it starts with grounding yourself. So before we could even move to know yourself, there has to be at least some measure of groundedness and embodied awareness. So an awareness that isn't just about thinking and having a rational experience of the world or only a mental experience mm-hmm. of the world, but really has a full embodied experience of the world. So know yourself then involves all the aspects of ourselves. And that includes our history and our legacies. It's an awareness of our patterns and our triggers. It's also an awareness of our gifts and our power. And that is quite a reckoning. You know, we really have to do the work. And some of that work can be done through meditation, I believe. You can sit down for 10 minutes and start to understand a lot about yourself when you see where your mind goes, what thought patterns are persistent, what tension you feel in your body, and what those tensions might reveal about where you're holding and what you're holding. And it also requires an investigation of our traumas and our relational patterns. So it's not only about meditation, knowing yourself, it's really kind of an accounting of our whole lives, in a sense. And included in our lives is our ancestral lineages and our intergenerational patterns. So I talk about epigenetics and the fact that we now know, although again, indigenous wisdom knew this as well before science showed up, or modern science showed up, that things are handed down to us in terms of our physical appearance and reality. So, you know, you have the color eyes you do and the hair you have and the body you have because of genetic information. But there's also epigenetic information that's handed down, which refers to experiences that then change our genetic material. So both traumas and very strong positive experiences can change our genetic material. So things like anxiety and depression and certain behavior patterns and thought patterns are literally passed down through the generations. And we can start to know that by paying attention to our ancestry.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you discovered that trauma is not necessarily a negative thing, but it's more like a gift that was handed down to you. And it's up to us to bring that to the consciousness and to really understand if that's useful now in our context. When I was in university, I was lucky enough to be the university where I studied in Italy. We awarded Isabella Allende with a ad honorem degree. So she came over and she gave this speech. She talked about her experience moving to the US as she thought of herself as a potted plant. And because usually plants have roots and they're grounded. So she thought of herself, and because her parents and her family were doing a lot of moving around, she thought like, okay, she'll never get to set up plants. But eventually she said that when she was there, she eventually realized that her pot became too small, and she cracked open and she actually settled roots in the United States. So she feels American in that sense, even though she came from Chile. And somebody like me, that really meant a lot, that the metaphor of being in a potted plant, that's how I felt many years. And then I realized that there are no roots in the sense that I am already grounded. I am already part of this world. And even in those moments where I felt like I didn't belong, I actually belonged. That was a huge revelation for me. Yeah, when you wrote that on your book. Even when we don't feel like we belong, you belong nonetheless. And the things you talk about, and it's very related to what we were just talking about, that not belonging is actually experienced through our bodies. Can you explain what you mean about that? Like, not belonging is experienced through our bodies.
Yeah, again, this points back to the fact that we're really trained and conditioned to understand everything through our rational minds in this culture. And by this culture, I mean modern culture. And so we think of not belonging as an experience that has to do with thought forms. And it often shows up as anxiety or sadness or these emotions. But all of our belonging or not belonging is actually an embodied experience. That if I feel like I don't belong and there's sadness, there's an emotional response in the body. That if I feel anxiety, there's actually a corresponding physical sensory experience. So paying attention to that bodily experience is actually our our way back to a sense of belonging. You know, often when we're upset and we don't have an embodied awareness practice, we can just kind of circle through thoughts all the time and we'll stay there because thoughts trigger other thoughts and go into stories and then go into patterns and then they become behaviors that perpetuate those thoughts. But if we can actually stay with the sensory experience of what's happening, there is an opportunity to recognize that these sensations that, you know, might be the heart beating really fast or a clenching sensation in our stomach or tears or, you know, kind of a watery feelings bubbling up in our throats or in our eyes, that those things actually have a beginning and an end. They're impermanent. And it's said scientifically that emotions, you know, only last a couple of dozen seconds in our bodies. And it's our thoughts that actually perpetuate the emotion and the physical sensation to continue. So when we can actually just pay attention to the physical sensation and really ride it out as we would kind of surf a wave, we actually reach a shore if we just stay on that. If not, we'll actually be in a wave machine that'll just keep us stuck, you know, in that pattern for, you know, sometimes decades.
Yeah. Some people don't even realize that they're in that pattern and they just live their lives. Yeah. Which is very unfortunate. So,
it really is. And it's really common, you know, and you know, one of the things I really encourage people to do is to just recognize that these are patterns and behaviors often handed down through generations, and it's not your fault. It's your responsibility to exit that pattern because no one can do it for you. But it's not a failure. It's just a perpetuation of things that we've learned, and we've learned them through our ancestral lineages. We've learned them in our families. We've learned them in our communities.
Through our culture,
Through our culture, but it's not our nature. I heard Martha Beck, the life coach and author, the other day say that the opposite of culture is nature. And I love that because when I reflected on it more deeply, I thought, oh, we are nature, but we make culture. And sometimes we think we are culture, but culture is something that we can shift and mold and transform. And so if we can recognize that we've been shaped by culture, but our true nature is to awaken and to really feel that sense of belonging, even with our uniqueness, you know, we don't have to sacrifice our difference in uniqueness to feel that belonging. There's so much bounty there.
We don't have to sacrifice our differences and our uniqueness to feel our belonging. Wow. That was just amazing. Now, I had the pleasure of listening to this conversation multiple times, and every time I listen to this recording, I'm able to extract just a new piece of wisdom. So that was part one. I hope you get to listen to it over again. And please send me some feedback, even if it's just a thumbs up. The next part, we pick up on belonging with others. While this part was about grounding ourselves and understanding our true nature, we later explore how can we as individuals belong in a greater society. I hope by now that you are clicking on the show notes links, finding out, reading more about Sabine Selassie, going to her website, and you can find her book on Amazon. I also highly recommend that you pick up the audiobook because it was narrated by Sabine herself, and she is an amazing narrator and author, and I cannot speak highly enough of Sabine. And for now, I will leave you, and I will now get back to editing part two. I hope that you can join us then. But until then, go and create belonging for yourself and for others. Thank you.